The next case is 95-1222, Thomas J. Burns versus LCI Communication Holdings Company. Mr. Ricard.
Mr. Chief Justice, if it please the court, Your Honors, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of my time.
Put your time on the clock there.
As the court is aware, this case comes to this court from the Court of Appeals of Franklin County, an age discrimination case, where the Court of Appeals affirmed that Judge Close dissented a judgment in favor of the plaintiffs in excess of $7 million. A case in which the trial judge said 98% of the evidence of record in this case has nothing to do with age discrimination. In Commesher against the Kroger Company, this court set forth two evidentiary paths for a plaintiff in an age discrimination case to establish a prima facie case of discrimination, either by direct evidence or the four-pronged standard of Barker against Gold, the last prong of which requires that the plaintiff make a showing that he or she has been replaced by someone who is not a member of the protected class. The plaintiffs here, Burns and Otto, were 48 and 58 when they were hired, 51 and 61 at the time they were terminated as president and vice president of LCI. They were not replaced by younger workers, and Burns himself admitted that when he discharged Otto, he did not take age into consideration.
In fact, were they replaced at all?
No, Your Honor, they were not. Burns was replaced by McLernan. He took over his duties at the time that he was discharged.
But somebody was already there.
That's right.
Somebody was already there assumed both of their duties.
They're the same age. The evidence of discrimination in this record consists of seven remarks over an 8-year period, most of which were made before these plaintiffs were even hired by LCI, and which related to plaintiffs or other persons performing duties that were markedly different from those that were performed by the plaintiffs.
At what point, you raise an issue that I guess I saw as one that sort of was kind of like mercury. At what point do statements such as were made here over a period of time regarding some attitude about age, but not directed at these plaintiffs, at what point do those statements, because is there a bright line test that we can write on this about statements made, offhand statements that are made that become actionable?
There's not a bright line test, Mr. Chief Justice, but there is a standard that they be reasonably related in terms of time, in terms of people who are similarly situated, in terms of disparate treatment between older and younger employees in the same job classification. And finally, and this is present in every case, the evidence must relate to the plaintiff, the job classification at issue, or the challenge decision.
I guess it's significant here that at least some of the statements were made about the, as I recall, the sales force, where statements such as we want some young, eager people in their sales force versus the tired old man or something like that. Your argument would be that there's a distinction between even assuming that those statements are actionable as to those employees that here we're talking about the top executive staff and that with respect to those persons, age might be a, one would like to think that age might be a favorable factor. In other words, experience, they're both hired because of their experience. And is that something we should look to? Or?
Absolutely, Your Honor. The evidence is, it's absolutely clear. I'm telling you, the evidence on this record shows only one comment after the fact with respect to a secretary. And every other comment is directed at someone who is employed in the sales and marketing function. And as the First Circuit said in Medina against Munoz, it is too much of a leap to go from the sales and marketing function, which was at issue in that case as well, to the executive ranks of the company. There is just no evidence whatsoever in this record that ties any of these comments to either these plaintiffs, the job classifications that they have, or the challenge decision with respect to their termination.
Discrimination, though, is a mental attitude, and so it's almost impossible ever to establish it by direct evidence. And isn't it the entire philosophy of a company has to be taken into consideration in doing that? The comments that were made permeate the entire philosophy of this company.
I submit that that is not the case, Justice Herzog. In these cases, what we're really talking about here is a sufficiency standard. The Commissioner standard performs a very crucial screening function. It enables trial courts concerned about the conservation of judicial resources to screen out non-meritorious cases. And it assures fairness to defendants in cases where 98% of the evidence has nothing to do with age discrimination against receiving a $7 million judgment. That's an important function and it can't be ignored. I'm not saying in this case that evidence with respect to other employees should not be considered. What I am saying is what gives it its probative value is its timeliness, is it reasonably related to the action at issue. Secondly, if it is with respect to other people, are they similarly situated to the plaintiffs in this case? Here, they are not. And with respect to those people, and this goes back to your question, Chief Justice Moyer, is there evidence that they were treated differently from younger employees in their department? Here, there is not only no evidence that these people were similarly situated, there's no evidence that they were treated differently from younger employees in the sales department. And finally, do the comments provide some nexus to either these plaintiffs, the job classification at issue, for the challenge decision? That's present in every case. Now, direct evidence is really not that difficult to come by, Your Honor.
Counsel?
Yes,
I'm
Justice.
I'm following up on Justice Resnick. Doesn't the overall attitude of the corporation towards this subject play an important part in the determination whether there is age discrimination?
Your Honor, we have to be very careful in saying that an overall attitude, first of all,
can be used at all,
can be drawn from a few stray, isolated comments, which Judge Close noted did not provide an action basis in this case, and whether this so-called overall attitude has anything to do with these plaintiffs, their job classification, or the challenge decision.
So you feel that that should be the
no.
basis at all?
In every case, Commissioner itself, in Your Honor's opinion, had direct evidence of discrimination. That plaintiff was selected for a reduction in force because of his age. The case is relied upon by the plaintiffs here, Tyler against Bethlehem Steel. It's a carbon copy of Commissioner. The plaintiff was selected for a reduction in force because of his age. In Cooley, the plaintiff's supervisor wanted to get rid of older city managers. The plaintiff was a city manager. In LaPointe, the decision maker said people holding union office with 30 years of service ought to get out and let younger guys in. The plaintiff was a union official with 30 years of service.
So those comments that made in passing or general conversations have to be directed at the person involved in the
at the person, at the job classification for the decision. In Pricewaterhouse, the plaintiff was told that if she talked, walked, and acted in more feminine fashion, her chances might improve for partnership. Those were comments obviously directed right at the plaintiff. In the Turbovitz case, the plaintiff was told no female will ever hold this position, the position the plaintiff was making application for.
Mr. McCartan, in this case, is the stock issue different than the discrimination issue? Because if, in fact, we follow what you're arguing and reverse this and enter judgment for the defendant on the basis of no discrimination, we never get to prejudgment interest or
punitive
damages.
That's
or any
correct.
Emotional distress, any of those arguments.
That's
is
correct. In our
stock,
position.
Is the stock issue separate?
Stock issue separate from the liability issue here?
Yes, sir.
No, if the plaintiffs were properly terminated, then what they are entitled to receive was the vested stock that they were entitled to at the time they left.
And not that accelerated...
Not the accelerated amount.
So
that's correct.
So it is related, but they still get what their sort of value, their stock at the time of termination.
That's correct.
Thank you.
That's correct.
Can you summarize for me again the differences between why these two points of companies rationale were terminated? What was the difference between the two terminations?
Between the two terminations, I think basically were based upon the same kind of lack of performance on the part of each of the plaintiffs. The plaintiff Otto, who was responsible for the integration of the charter network, did not do a good enough job at that to have Burns, his immediate supervisor and president of the company, give him a favorable performance rating for the third quarter of 1990. He had not performed up to standard and was discharged by Burns himself, who said he did not take the age into consideration. Burns, after starting out 1990 as a pretty good year, found out as they neared the end of the year that they were going to miss their revenue target by $53 million. Situation that resulted in the layoff of 13% of the total workforce. He received an unsatisfactory performance rating for the third quarter and was terminated by Mr. McLernan, who assumed his duties. So they were both terminated in effect for poor performance. And what I want to emphasize is that whether you are talking about direct or circumstantial evidence, this case is not the proper vehicle to expand the Kohlmescher syllabus. Because the so-called toothpaste theory...
Is that one that toothpaste theory, is that one that Judge Tyack dreamt up himself, or is that one we'll find someplace in Corpus Juris Secundum or some other area?
Well, Your Honor,
that
it came right off.
He talked as if it was something that had been accepted. It's an interesting theory, but I...
With no due respect, or with no lack of respect for Judge Tyack, I think it came right off the top of his head. And maybe I'm saying here what I'm really thinking.
It might be off the top of his head, but it's in his opinion.
It's in his opinion, Your Honor, and I'd like to talk about that for a moment. And I think it's significant that the plaintiffs here make no real effort to support that theory. This is a theory based upon what he saw, Judge Tyack saw, in the record, which I submit is not present, and upon examination will be found not to be present in this record, of a pattern, a plan, a program of hiring older, more experienced employees, teaming them with younger, feisty marketing types, squeezing the tube, squeezing the older employees for the experience that you could get from them, discarding the tube, firing the employees and replacing them with younger employees.
Don't assume that over the, my question means I'm over the liability issue, because I understand your argument. I want to know,
I know that, Your Honor.
Do we follow Worrell in the front pay issue?
Yes, Your Honor, I submit you should. Front pay is in the nature of an equitable remedy. I think it requires that kind of a finding before the matter is submitted to the jury under appropriate instructions. That was not done here.
Did the Court of Appeals follow Worrell?
Pardon, Your Honor?
Did the Court of Appeals follow Worrell?
No. The Court of Appeals said that because the case was submitted to the jury, he obviously made the finding that was required by Worrell, and he did. But if I may go back for a moment to the toothpaste tube theory. The so-called pattern that formed the basis for that theory was based upon the testimony of Ed Florek, who was terminated before these plaintiffs even joined LCI. And Florek himself admitted that the so-called plan, the mentor plan for the sales and marketing function, was never even implemented before he left the company. That's in the transcript of 1019 at page 62. So the so-called pattern didn't exist. And what we are left with are seven stray remarks over an eight-year period that have no nexus or connection to either these plaintiffs, to the job classification at issue, which is an executive position, or to the action terminating them.
Your opponent will remind us that they are connected to the extent that the decision-maker, Clarkin, was voiced some of that. What is called discriminatory animus. He's the decision maker. So is that sufficient connection?
Your Honor, I submit that neither this court nor any other court in the cases that they rely upon will say that that is a sufficient connection to justify termination on age discrimination grounds in the case of this county. That does not provide the nexus that the cases uniformly require before proof of age discrimination will be held sufficient to submit the case to the jury. When you think about it, what the toothpaste theory comes down to, all you need to satisfy that theory, some remarks at some point in time, unrelated to the plaintiffs, having nothing to do with their job classification, directed at people who are not similarly situated, and who may or may not have been terminated because of their age. That's another thing that's absent on this record, and as the Simpson case, the Sixth Circuit's opinion in Simpson demonstrates, is essential. The only reason you make comparisons to other people, other employees, is to show some evidence of disparate treatment. The plaintiffs here only proved one half of that equation. They proved that these people either left or were terminated. They didn't even prove a discrimination case with respect to those people in the sales and marketing department. There is no evidence that those people who either left or were terminated were treated any differently in that department from younger employees.
Spend all your time arguing the prong of Commeisher on direct evidence. What about the fourth part of the second test, that is being replaced by somebody not of the protected category?
They were not replaced by anyone who was not a member of the protected class.
Isn't that as strong argument as you have, as well as the direct evidence?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And,
but I just didn't want you to have to sit down without getting that second test, because that was pretty important to us when we crafted it.
It is important, and I think that if you look at the Court of Appeals opinion, it's very obvious that they are departing from that standard. The Court concedes that they were not replaced by anyone younger. Commeisher is really a circumstantial evidence standard. That is the four-pronged Barker portion of Commeisher.
But in light of O'Connor, the Supreme Court opinion, if this court were to adopt that new reasoning, that the fourth prong really isn't properly tied to showing discrimination, I'm sure you weren't in case, if this court were to adopt that as your claim, as your case,
The defendant should win, Your Honor. O'Connor is only of marginal significance in this case. As you will recall there, the plaintiff was 50-something years old, replaced by a 40-year-old worker. The court said that it really doesn't have to be shown that it's precisely within the parameters of the protected class, as long as the replacement is substantially younger. And in this case, there were no replacements in either category. So you don't have a question of whether they were substantially younger or within the precise delineation of the Commeisher standard, Justice Douglas, that they would be replaced by someone who's not a member of the protected class.
Thank you, Mr. McCurtain.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Kell.
May it please the Court. My name is Russell Kilm, and I represent the plaintiffs, Thomas Burns and Richard Otter, in this proceeding. Both of the plaintiffs are with me in the courtroom today.
Let me start out with a threshold question, Mr. Kilm, if I may. I took it from your brief that this theory that the Court of Appeals, at least the two judges of the Court of Appeals, adopted, the so-called toothpaste theory, you didn't seem to argue much about that. Your argument was based on the presence of direct evidence. Should we not worry about the toothpaste theory from your standpoint? Right.
It only became a toothpaste theory at the pen of Mr. McCartney. That toothpaste theory came out of the evidence at trial that Mr. Burns testified that he felt like a used tube of toothpaste with all of the contents squeezed out and he'd be tossed aside after his knowledge was absorbed by the company. The Court of Appeals picked up that feeling, and Mr. McCartan put it to paper as a toothpaste theory of liability to demean the evidence that was presented.
Well, it's in the Court of Appeals' opinion, though. I mean, Appeals didn't have to use the term.
Judge Tyack read the record.
Yeah.
He saw that, in fact, that the plaintiff had testified about feeling like he used toothpaste.
But it seems like a different theory than Commeisher. I guess I'm just going to make sure that the law, we agree on what the law is here.
Justice Moyer, if you believe Commeisher says that only the four-prong McDonnell-Douglas test is usable in discrimination cases, then you're right, that this case doesn't prevail under the McDonnell-Douglas test. This case fits within Commissioner under the direct evidence test. And the question before this court is, what is direct evidence? And that's an important question that needs to be clarified to all of the plaintiff's lawyers and all the defense lawyers that practice in this area. Direct evidence in this area isn't just a statement by the supervisor. Direct evidence is any evidence that can be used in any legal proceeding. There's no reason in discrimination cases that you can't prove these cases by the normal run of evidence, which means direct, circumstantial, and statistical evidence.
Why would the court have used the word direct? I mean, why would we modify evidence by the word direct if it's just evidence?
Justice Cook, the reason is that evidence that's direct is evidence that relates to the issue. In McDonnell Douglas, the evidence is indirect because...
It just means relevant. If it relates to
it's
the
relevant
issue.
Evidence.
Relevant evidence,
right.
Is that different from direct?
The interesting explanation of what direct means is in the Tyler versus Bethlehem Steel case in the Second Circuit. They explain it fully on why direct evidence is just a bad word, a bad phrase used and been adopted by a number of courts. In fact, that evidence, if we can't, for instance, we could convict people of murder on circumstantial evidence, can't we convict them or find them liable for discrimination on circumstantial evidence? You would think so. The problem that has developed since McDonnell Douglas in 1973 in all of the courts is that they use those four-prong tests to the exclusion of all other tests, and that's wrong. This court corrected that in part in Commissioner when it said, if you don't have direct evidence, then you use McDonnell Douglas. The problem that's happened is no one has defined, this court has not defined what direct evidence is. In Tyler, the Second Circuit defined that.
You're essentially your argument. I gather if we adopt Tyler that it means relevant evidence.
Correct.
That's it.
Correct.
And, so, I guess with that in mind, do you require any kind of link to
absolutely
nexus to the exact action that's taken as to your clients?
The link you picked up earlier in question, Justice Cook, is the link to the decision maker. In the case of Mr. McCartan said there's no cases that support a link to a decision maker as being a basis, well, he should read Price Waterhouse and he should read Cooley because they expressly say that. Justice Cook, when you argued Barker versus Scoville to this court in 1983, I think you were plaintiff's counsel at that time, you didn't have a direct evidence standard to fall back on. You had a four-prong McDonnell-Douglas test, and you couldn't satisfy one of those prongs, and you lost that case. But you had direct evidence that you presented at trial that you persuaded at that time a decision-maker, not a jury, that you showed discrimination. You were foreclosed because, I think, a misinterpretation of the case law at the time. McDonnell-Douglas had not been developed, and the parameters of going beyond McDonnell-Douglas had not been developed. There's two issues before this court today that are very important to develop for this area of the law in the state of Ohio, and that's what is direct evidence under Commissioner. I believe that standard is any type of evidence used in any civil case, which means direct evidence, circumstantial evidence, and statistical evidence. The second issue that's very important for you today is punitive damages.
Could I ask, you would say that it is sufficient that we have a decision maker who has displayed discriminatory animus, that's sufficient nexus and direct evidence.
Absolutely. Price Waterhouse versus Hopkins in 1989, the U.S. Supreme Court said biased statements by the decision maker are probative evidence.
The circuits are divided there. Mr. McCartan's right, but there are a lot of cases that say that is insufficient. And then you have cited this case.
Justice Cook, in this area, because of the wide range of types of people who are federal judges, you can find a case to support any theory. The Cooley decision in the Sixth Circuit, Cooley versus Carmike Cinemas, expressly went on to the decision maker, and it held that evidence that was as much as 13 years old, where the decision maker at age 18 had said he didn't like old people. When he was 32 and fired old people, they said it was relevant evidence to go back to that decision maker and show that age-based animus that went back 13 years in his history. We went back 8 years. Now I want to correct another point. Mr. McCartan says there's eight direct statements of discriminatory animus by McCartan. There were 18 in the record. The evidence in this case was overwhelming, it was pervasive, and it continued for a long, long time. It continued for 8 years from his first secretary to his last decision in terminating Mr. Burns.
Was it directed at, I guess the question is, was it directed at these plaintiffs? Wasn't most of it directed at other employees and different classifications?
Mr. Moore, your question reverts to the standard of, does direct evidence mean the decision maker said, you're too old, you're fired?
Well, I'm beyond direct evidence. I'm now, okay. I'm trying to link up the statements. Say they're all direct statements.
Okay.
Now, do they relate to the plaintiffs?
Yes. One of them did. Mr. McLaren said to Mr. Burns, I think Mr. Otto has Alzheimer's.
Okay.
That's a direct discriminatory statement.
Is that the only one we have that links with
yes,
the...
Yes, because this decision maker was a smart decision maker. He was the chairman of the board of the company. He knew better than to walk up to an old person and say, you're too old, get out of here.
And he got
People
relieved.
Don't do that
He
anymore.
Got relieved himself later on, didn't he, by the board?
Well, he got fired.
Yeah.
He got fired. And that happens in any organization. This issue on direct evidence was before this case on March 4th in the Mousy versus Kelly Services case. That case hasn't yet, and there's been no opinion issued yet in that case. The issue is, what's the scope of direct evidence? Now, in that case, it came up on summary judgment. In this case, it comes up with a full evidentiary record. We have 18 separate incidents, and I can go through that with you. All of the quotes in the record, based discriminatory evidence. Justice Stratton?
Under your theory, if you sexually harass your secretary, can your partner's secretary then sue you? Isn't that what your theory
is? Well, the question then is, if the sexual harassment is not directed, or if the job action is not directed at the person who sues, no, you can't.
Isn't that what the defense are saying? Wasn't directed at them, it was directed
at them. They were terminated, Your
Honor. But they gave reasons to terminate.
Well, and that's where the 98% of the evidence that didn't deal with discrimination comes in. We had to show, they raised an affirmative defense, that they had cause to terminate them. And we spent most of the trial showing that, for instance, at a time when the profits of the company and the revenue of the company increased by 30%, the industry standard was 10%, they said my client's performance was subpar because he didn't reach 50%. Is that pretext?
But neither were replaced by younger people, isn't that correct?
Neither were replaced.
In fact, one was replaced by an older person.
Well, in fact, Lytel, as it was known at the time, was very astute in this area. They thought if you created a position, in Toto's case, a new position, you eliminated the position, that you could eliminate the fourth prong of McDonnell-Douglas and never be sued for discrimination. What they didn't count on was what Gomesher says, that direct evidence of discrimination was useful in these cases. This case is very important to send a message. And the message...
Counsel,
I'm sorry.
I guess I'm persuaded that the word direct, as it applies to evidence, as a boogeyman, that we ought to get beyond.
We need to move past that word.
Could you just briefly articulate what your strong case is for age discrimination, direct, indirect, circumstantial, statistical, anything that you want to bring into the under the tent from an evidentiary standpoint, as opposed to being fired for lack of performance or whatever they say. I mean, people get fired every day.
Sure.
Because the boss just plain doesn't like him.
And that's fine. Legal.
The boss may say, well, you didn't perform or you didn't achieve 50% when the industry standard is 10%. But the real reason is the guy above or the woman above just plain is tired of looking at it.
Right.
The person in the office next door is
right. And that's the employer has to move forward with evidence. Once it's established that there's discriminatory evidence, it has to move forward with evidence to show a legitimate business justification for the action it's taken. I can tell you in the trial of these cases, and I tried many, the trial of these cases, 90% of the time you deal with that business justification. You can establish the discriminatory animus freely in most of these cases, or plaintiff's lawyers won't take the cases. The case then turns on whether the evidence is to be believed by the jury when the defendant gets on the stand, and they all do, I swear to tell the truth, I did not discriminate on the basis of age, sex, race, nationality, they all say it. And you have to determine whether you believe it or not.
So what's the strength, what's the strongest points of your case?
The bright line of this case is 18 age discriminatory statements and actions made by the decision maker who terminated both men, one indirectly, one directly.
Well, the counter argument to that is that these 18 statements, 17 of them didn't apply to these particular plaintiffs. What do you have to say about that?
They never do. Okay,
but we have cases where they do. I mean, they certainly do.
Judge Resnick, the problem is that these statutes have been on the books for 20 to 30 years. And people know you can't make those statements to the person that you're going to affect. If you have an age discriminatory animus, you don't say it to someone who's 55. You say it to someone who's 30. Don't you wish we get rid of these old guys? That's what McLaren was doing. He was saying it to younger people. If you find sexist comments in the workplace, that you want to use to show an animus.
Let's confine ourselves to this particular case and tell them why the plaintiff established age discrimination based upon all of these.
The plaintiff here showed first direct age discriminatory statements about the plaintiff Otto, Alzheimer's disease. And there's a number of federal cases that say that saying that someone, that believing someone has Alzheimer's, particularly when it's untrue, which it was here, is an age discriminatory statement. Then we established a plan. Mr. McLaren was going to build this company from scratch with experienced telephone company workers. He was going to bring them in for a few years, use up their knowledge, and discard them, as Mr. Burns testified about, like an old toothpaste tube. He did that. What we then showed was the execution of that plan. We showed the hiring of a number of people, including these two plaintiffs, that they saved only several years, in this case 2 years or 3 years, of full-time employment, and that they were cast out with no sufficient business justification for the decision when it was made. In fact, at the time the decision was made, or just prior to the decision being made, they'd approved the man for a 10% raise, Mr. Burns. They'd given Mr. McLaren, the chairman of the company, a huge bonus in each of the two quarters before Burns was discharged. The economic performance of the company is responsible for
this. What you're saying is that these 18 statements showed a pattern of discrimination.
They show the animus. And then the plan being introduced, where McLaren went and talked to these younger employees about, this is how I think I'll grow the company. He talked about it in the sales context, but he obviously implemented it in all contexts. Of the 11 original officers of this company, when they did a leveraged buyout in 1988, only one remains in the company. All of these people are gone. All of them.
Is that typical, though? We have a change in management.
Justice Stratton, there is no company in this city where the 11 top, 10 of the 11 top officers from 7 years ago are gone. No.
Yeah, but companies that have recently purchased and changed hands, that's the difference.
This company is still owned and controlled by Warburg Pincus in New York that controlled it in a leveraged buyout in 1988. This company has not been purchased and changed hands. Now, I want to say, and I want to turn briefly to the punitive damages issue. The only court in this state that has found that punitive damages are not appropriate in these cases is the Stark County Court of Appeals. And they did it as dicta. Every federal and state court, including courts of appeals, that have considered the issue have allowed punitive damages. These cases are intentional torts. You cannot negligently discriminate. You only intentionally discriminate. And much like an assault, the only way that you stop an intentional tort is punitive damages. Punitive damages are allowed by the language of 4112.02M and 99 because damages, the term damages, is not limited. This court has hinted at that in several cases. It needs to firmly decide that issue. The fact is that this court has to show that intentional discrimination has a cost, more than just giving back a paycheck, which is back pay and front pay. There has to be a downside. Only the prospect of punitive damages will make a discriminatory conduct stop. Age discrimination isn't something that rarely happens. It's all around us. We're all in the protected class. Every one of you and I am in this protected class. Corporate downsizing has become rampant in Ohio, and it has to stop affecting older people. We need to draw a line in the sand, and we need to do it now.
Council, I
guess you're
sympathetic to some of the rhetoric.
Age discrimination is
city of Simsbury.
It's very hard to distinguish, but you just threw out, I've been thinking about that, exactly, no place in this city where top management is turned over like this. Well, thinking of the climate, your firm is limited, and you've got a very dynamic and forceful chairman. And it seems to me, as I read the business pages, every so often when they underperform, they just clean house out there in terms of management.
They don't. And some of the key people have been there as long as I've been representing that company, which is a long time.
But a lot of good people who come in with great resumes and great background.
Occasionally. The difficulty used to be in the limited, Justice Piper, that no one was over 40. Now that's changed and they've aged, and there are some that are in fact over 40.
But isn't that the difficulty in these cases?
The difficulty is
sorting out between business judgments, personality conflicts, and age discrimination.
That's why we have juries. That's why we present the full finality of the evidence. We let the company come in and say there's a business reason for it, and we let the jury decide. That's the Ohio way, that's the American way of deciding difficult fact issues. It isn't an issue that this court decides. The jury decided in this case. It decided unanimously, and it decided with a $7 million message. And that message needs to be affirmed.
Thank you, Mr. Kellen. Mr. McCartney, you've used your time, but take 30 seconds.
If I may, then, Your Honor, Mr. Kelm invited me to read Pricewaterhouse and Cooley. I'd like to read just two very brief quotations from each of those cases. In Pricewaterhouse, where you recall the plaintiff was told that if she could dress, talk, and walk in more feminine fashion, her chances for partnership would be improved. If that is in evidence related to the decisional process, I don't know what is. But Justice O'Connor said, stray remarks in the workplace, while perhaps probative of sexual harassment, cannot justify requiring the employer to prove that his hiring or promotion decisions were based on legitimate criteria. Nor can statements by non-decision makers or statements by decision makers unrelated to the decisional process itself satisfy the plaintiff's burden. In Cooley, which Mr. Kelm also invited me to read, and which I have, I would quote as follows. A reasonable jury could have viewed the accumulated testimony as going beyond the vague, ambiguous, and isolated comments that have been held insufficient to support an age discrimination claim. They were comments attributed to decision makers, related to the decision-making process, and quoted by co-workers who had these discussions with Cooley's superiors during the course of their employment. What these cases demonstrate, and I submit to this court upon examination, you will not find any case where there is not present some nexus between the plaintiffs, the job classification involved, or the challenge decision, as was the case in both Pricewaterhouse and Cooley. That evidence is not in this record. And what Mr. Kelm is inviting the court to do is to discard the sufficiency test entirely. Submit it all to the jury. When the jury is finished, anything will stand because it has to be sufficient. The courts of the state of Ohio will no longer have a sufficiency test that will enable them to discard and weed out non-meritorious claims, and defendants are going to be subjected to anything that goes in cases of this kind.
Thank you.
I submit the decision should be reversed.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.
Thank you.